Okay, can we make a start then, folks? Welcome to Saturday morning. Welcome to the hangover slot. Mike usually calls it the hangover slot, and he very kindly and very bravely awards himself that slot. Yeah.
Grunt for punishment, more like.
Mike's going to be speaking about alienation at work, so it sounds like all good fun. All right, Mike, over to you.
Yeah, no, I don't know about good fun. It's one of those dreary talks moaning about how bad capitalism is, I'm afraid, and not necessarily what we want if we're having a nice weekend away in the sun in sunny Birmingham to be reminded of the horrors and evils of life at work, but there you go. So this is a talk about one of the most important aspects of Marxism, alienation. I'll describe what alienation is and the different ways people are alienated within the workplace and within capitalism. And I'll go into a bit more detail about how we experience alienation when we're employed, and especially in our relationships with our colleagues and customers and other people we come into contact with while we're at work. I'll be describing three main ways that our job alienates us from those we meet at work, and then I'll talk about how we can and how we perhaps should cope with this. So I'll start with a reminder of some of the basics of Marxist theory, and this will be a few points which I'm sure we're all familiar with, but they provide us with the background to what I'll be going into a bit more detail about later on. Firstly, in capitalism, we need money to buy food, shelter, clothing. I said I'll be starting off with the absolute basics. So to get this money, of course, we need to sell our labour power to an employer in exchange for wages. The employer buys our labour in a similar way to how they would buy other resources. They acquire our time and effort for 8 hours a day, or however long it is, just as they would buy electricity or a ream of paper or a computer. So employment is a transaction between ourselves and an employer. And this is one of the things that Marx was referring to when he said that in capitalism we have material relationships between people rather than social relationships between people. And that's somewhere in Volume 1 of Capital. And because we as a working class don't own the means of production, the organisations we work for confront us as if they are alien, independent objects. As employees, we're components of a much larger machine, which, along with its resources and its products, belongs to someone else. And we end up fetishising them. We treat them as something separate to ourselves, and therefore with some sort of power or authority over ourselves. By fetishising capitalist organisations, we allow them to shape our beliefs and our behaviour. And so we comply with the roles, hierarchies, rules and procedures which are in place to support capitalist organisations. So this is briefly the Marxist theory of alienation. I'll be discussing how being employed shapes not just our own outlook, but also our relationships with other people. So let's go into a bit more detail about what we mean by alienation. And an easy starting point, the one I've used, is Wikipedia, which is a brilliant resource because it means you don't have to go trawling through books in the libraries. It's all at the click of a button, one of the wonders of the 21st century. So the simplest definition of alienation, which is right at the top of the Wikipedia entry, you can see I spent hours researching this by looking at headings on Wikipedia. And the definition is of alienation is the separation of things that naturally belong together and the placement of antagonism between things that are properly in harmony. So, applied to people, this means that someone is alienated if they're separated from or made antagonistic to towards other things which, in other, probably better circumstances, they would be living in harmony with. So, my main source here will be Marx's 1844 Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts. Not the original cover, but the cover that looked best on a slide. And in particular, there's a section of this book called Estranged Labour. Now, there's some disagreement about how much importance is attached to Marx's early writings compared to, you know, works like Capital. Personally, I think that his early work builds a philosophical framework, which Marx later fleshed out in more detail later on, using the terminology of economics. But even if you're not a fan of Marx's early writings, then you should be able to relate to much of what I'm going to say. So Marx described the different ways that people in capitalism are alienated. Firstly, workers are alienated from the products of their labour. When we make something, we're objectifying our labour power. In other words, we're using our energy, muscle, creativity to produce something new. Whether it's a component in a factory, a report, a song, or a sandwich, sort of anything. And as we don't have ownership of the places where we work or the resources that we use, so we don't have ownership over what we produce. The results of our labour are therefore alien to us, or in other words, we're alienated from them. So that's one of the ways that we're alienated in capitalism. This also means that we're alienated from the act of producing. If we don't own our workplaces or the resources that we use, then we're not likely to find our work fulfilling, or we're likely to feel bored or powerless or stressed. But it runs a bit deeper than that, and it affects our whole identity. We're not likely to feel that we're really ourselves when we're employed. And a third aspect of alienation is that we're distanced from our species being. This isn't maybe the easiest concept to grasp. Some people would say human nature, but I think that's sort of a misleading way of approaching this. But when Marx says that we're a species being, he's saying that we, as a species, are part of nature. Again, that's obvious. And this is one of the things that differs us from other animals, we can self-consciously adapt the world around us. And we do this partly by thinking about how we fit into society and by being cooperative and forming lasting and meaningful relationships. So in short, species being is our self-awareness of our wider role on the planet. And of course, our wider role in the world involves other people. And being alienated from other people, which is the main thing I'll be talking about, is the fourth aspect of alienation, which Marx described. Our instinct to be cooperative and sociable is corrupted by the structure of capitalist organisations. And we recognise this as a gut feeling. It's an emotion. I think it's better to describe alienation as an emotion rather than as a theory, although that's not to say that the two are incompatible. So we experience alienation from other people as fear of an intimidating manager, as indifference to a shop assistant, as antagonism towards someone in uniform, for example. So I'll be going into a bit more detail about this aspect of alienation. So I'll be describing three aspects of employment shape our relationships with other workers. There's our job description, our status in the company's hierarchy, and there are the company's written and unwritten rules. So first, let's see how our job description affects how we relate to other people. So our role in a capitalist workplace is usually expressed as a job description. It's the list of our expected duties, skills, working hours, that kind of thing, something we're all familiar with. And this is usually a list of things that we're supposed to be while we're at work. And going back to the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, Marx writes that in capitalism, and this is a quote, each man regards the other in accordance with the standard and the situation in which he as a worker finds himself. So what does he mean by this? I accept that I have to fill a role within a workplace, and my own opinions, emotions, desires, they're secondary to this, at least while I'm at work. The role or function must come first. Otherwise I'll risk losing my job. When I accept this of myself, then consciously or subconsciously I accept it of other people as well, you know, colleagues and customers and people you come into contact with. So I would end up seeing their function or seeing their role rather than the person behind the function or the role. So for me, the bored woman in the drab uniform behind the supermarket checkout, she doesn't need beliefs or talents or feelings. You know, as far as I'm concerned, when I'm blearily eyed getting my frozen ready meals to pop in the microwave while watching crap on television during the week, so while I'm preoccupied with that, as far as I'm concerned, and as far as the board of directors of the supermarket is concerned, she only exists to sell me my weekly rations. And Jean-Paul Sartre, there he is smoking a pipe. Jean-Paul Sartre, he described the way in which we relate to other workers especially those we don't have all that much contact with. And this is a quote. Their condition is wholly one of ceremony. The public demands of them that they realise it as a ceremony. There is the dance of the grocer, of the tailor, of the auctioneer, by which they endeavour to persuade their clientele that they are nothing but a grocer, an auctioneer, a tailor. A grocer who dreams is offensive to the buyer because such a grocer is not wholly a grocer. Society demands that he limit himself to his function as a grocer, just as the soldier at attention makes himself into a soldier thing with a direct regard which does not see it all, which is no longer meant to see, since it is the rule and not the interest of the moment which determines the points he must fix his eyes on, the sight fixed at 10 paces. There are indeed many precautions to imprison a man in what he is, as if we lived in perpetual fear that he might escape from it, that he might break away and suddenly elude his condition. And that's from Sartre's heavy, dense book, Being and Nothingness. So when someone we meet seems defined by their job role, we relate to the role more than to the person. And to some extent, this is reasonable. A surgeon should act like a surgeon when he's got his hands in your innards. We wouldn't want him to, you know, act in any other way in that kind of situation. And when we deal with other workers who we never meet, such as those who process our online orders after we've clicked a couple of buttons, or those who make those frozen ready meals that I pop in the microwave, we're only relating to them by their function, and we can't really do much else about that. The point is that there's something dehumanising if we only view others in terms of their job role. The same applies if we don't see beyond someone's status in the workplace. Now, let's turn to how our relationships at work are influenced or shaped by the hierarchical structure of capitalist organisations. Each worker's place in a particular organisation is enshrined in the structure charts, the family tree of the organisation. There you go, that's a typical one. Again, I got from Google Images. Google Images is sort of the second only to Wikipedia, I find, in quick and cheap and easy research. Don't know how people cope without it. So that's just lifted from Google Images. So this you know, it looks a bit like a family tree. And this type of family tree depicts the internal hierarchy of the capitalist organisation. For example, below the owners or the directors of the company, there will be managers, then section heads, then the larger number of workers responsible for their own work, but not responsible for other people or other people's work. So, in other words, some people are seen as more important than others. Now, there can't be satisfying cohesion between people when the organisation of which they're a part is run on hierarchical lines. This is because each grade is working from a different perspective. And these perspectives often conflict, as we know. The directors will be trying to maximise profits and minimise costs, and the lowest grades of staff will probably be too preoccupied with their own workloads to have any influence or even see the wider picture. And the managers and the section heads, they'll be sort of caught in the middle, chasing targets and trying to get the most out of their staff. Now, it could be argued that the workforce would all be gelled together by the common aim of the success of the organisation as a whole, whether that's measured in profits or targets or a satisfying end product. But there are inevitably antagonisms. The managers may have to impose redundancies or remove perks to cut costs. A section head may have to pressurise their staff to work harder. And individual workers may resent the ways that those higher up wield their power. And of course, when the main aim of an organisation is to maximise profits for an elite, then all workers should feel antagonised by working for something that's not in their own interests. So having a hierarchical structure in the workplace means that the people within it will be valued differently. That's obvious. The most obvious way this happens is through differing rates of pay. Not that there's ever any consistent correlation between how skilled or arduous a job is and how much you get paid for it. Being a carer for someone who's frail or unwell, for example, is one of the most needed and most useful jobs imaginable. But it's also one of the lowest paid if you're an assistant in a care home or supporting a relative at home. So it's understandable if someone who's on a low wage resents those who get higher pay for doing something they perceive is less arduous. But and as well as salary, another way that workers in hierarchical organisations differ in value is in the strength of their opinions. Often the value of our opinion is not related to the reasoning or the thought behind the opinion, but it's related to our position. So a junior member of staff might make a suggestion of how to do something better, but would find themselves ignored because of who they are. Whereas if a more senior member of staff, if they were to make exactly the same suggestion, they're more likely to be taken seriously because of their status. So generally, the more important you are, the more important your views are. And this reminds us that working in a hierarchy involves deference. There's a very thin line between respecting someone who's judged to be your superior and being apprehensive of them. There's often some anxiety lurking around how staff relate to their managers. We might be wary of how they would react if we disagreed with them, or we might be concerned that they don't see us as hardworking. And this could be the case even if your manager is the nicest person imaginable. And usually the experience of anxiety at work is like having a mild case of the flu. The participants feel mildly sick, yet they continue with normal activities because they do not feel bad enough to do what's necessary to get better. And that's a quote out of a book called Driving Fear Out of the Workplace, which is a bit self-helpy. It's not really sort of the way I'd approach it, but it's a useful quote nonetheless. So often, overall, we often feel powerless at work, that we have no influence in how things are run. We might want to contribute to the organisation in a different way, but rigid structures might prevent us from doing this. We often feel trapped by our role, not allowing us to prove our abilities. All of this can quickly lead to resentment of others and their position. These are negative emotions, of course, but if we're honest, sometimes we feel relieved that we aren't in a position where we have responsibility over other people or have to make difficult decisions. We might prefer a job where we don't have to do anything too crucial. But even this feeling is often linked to a lack of self-esteem, as if we don't have faith in ourselves to have more responsibility. So overall, hierarchies pull people apart rather than being the best way of organising. If workers within an institution are constantly being pulled apart from one another, then the situation is multiplied when we take into account the whole of the labour market. We're implicitly competing with other workers in rival organisations, which may be stronger or weaker in the market than the organisation that we work for. If the organisation we work for is at a disadvantage in the market, then we risk losing our job. And if we're out of work and need a job, then our status in society is reduced considerably. We then have to compete with others for the few opportunities that are around. Of course, this doesn't manifest itself in outright hostility towards other workers. Well, not unless you're a contestant on the Apprentice, of course. Most of the time, we are cooperative and helpful, even if the circumstances we find ourselves in don't encourage this. But overall, this situation does prevent the working class from acting together as a class. Our place in the structure chart and our job description both define our value and our function. And alongside this, there is the framework of procedures and rules of the workplace. These are the guidelines for that organisation, the do's and don'ts. These are the group norms or the social norms that govern how we behave. Most of the time, we want the groups that we're part of to be cohesive, and this applies at work as well as to friends or family, or comrades even. And how a group coheres depends on social norms or rules about what should and shouldn't be done. All societies need these norms in order to function, and so that their group or social norms aren't inherently alienating. And socialism, of course, would have its own frameworks and guidelines of, you know, what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And these would, of course, shape attitudes and behaviour. Many social norms are unwritten. For example, there's what someone that I used to know called urinal etiquette. And I'm sure a lot of the men in the room will know what I mean. In public toilets, men never use the urinal right next to someone else if you can possibly help it. You should always leave a gap of at least one urinal between yourself and your fellow urinators. And And these unwritten rules tend to lurk in the back of our heads until we need to put them into practice. And even then, we don't usually bother to think about them. And one example in the workplace might be that, for example, male members of staff have to wear ties, and ones that aren't too garish. And that could be a written rule rather than unwritten rule, depending on how strict the organisation is. Written rules are, by their very nature, more formal than unwritten ones. Sorry, I don't want to be compared with a group of men urinating. I'll go back to that so you're not distracted by the sight of that.
That's
all
it,
very, very funny. Stop taking the piss. Written rules are, by their very nature, more formal than unwritten ones. They might be set down in a code of conduct or corporate policy or even in law. And therefore, there will be a scale of penalties if you break them. And some of the policies and procedures may be perfectly reasonable in context. A teacher or a counsellor or a doctor would have to adhere to a set of professional boundaries. And these clarify how they should relate to those who they support. And this is particularly important if the person receiving the service is a child or is classed as vulnerable in some way or in a particular need. And this kind of code of conduct is for a particular kind of relationship. And I'm more interested here in the kind of rules which apply more generally in the workplace. So a lot of the time we follow written and unwritten guidelines in the workplace without thinking too much of the reasons behind them. And this particularly happens if you feel powerless. Over time, the way things are done magically turns into the way we believe things should be done. We learn to accept the culture because it provides some sort of predictability and order. Group norms can lead to a dreary kind of consensus if we're not careful. Over time, members of a group may find themselves sharing the same kinds of outlook and opinions. In the mid-90s, there was a series of experiments where volunteers were asked their opinion on a made-up scenario. And some of the volunteers were told what other people thought, what other people's opinions were on this scenario. And this group tended to follow the other people's opinions. So certain points of view will be reinforced if other people judge them to be appropriate. And another way that norms get perpetuated is if the workplace is run like an old boys' club. There's an old boys' club. No, that's not a photo of the SPGB in a meeting. I hasten to add. So the setup here is quite familiar. All the positions of authority are held by older men who've probably known each other for years, and they steer the organisations based on a shared set of values. They're likely to be slow to change, partly because they reinforce each other's similar views, and partly because they're less likely to recruit someone into their group who they perceive as different. In these days of supposed equal opportunities, old boys networks don't have to be made up of old boys as such, although senior management does, of course, still tend to be white, male and grey-haired. 4 out of 5 people in senior management roles are men. But the pattern can apply to women in any ethnic group, in theory. The point is that any particular demographic or social group can become defensive and aim for cohesion by preferring to only let in those it sees as similar. I'm sure there are some organisations where anyone who is male, white and grey-haired wouldn't fit in and therefore wouldn't be able to, or would find it difficult to get in, but that's probably the minority. And of course, this isn't always the case. I've worked in places where the workforce has been very diverse, and this gives the benefits of different perspectives and experiences. For many of us, the result of being employed is to constrict creative thought. The roles, hierarchies, policies and procedures will fill our heads, and following them will replace thinking about them. So what coping mechanisms, what coping strategies do we have other than trying to forget about work as much as possible when we're at home? One coping strategy, and not a very healthy one, is to get involved in office politics. Office politics relates to how people deal with the grumbling dissatisfaction which comes from treating people as job roles, deferring to authority and following unwanted procedures. And unfortunately, it's an example of how unsatisfied groups of people turn on each other. There you go, there's some office politics going on over here, gossip around the water cooler. So, of course, office politics isn't limited to offices, but also happens in shops, factories, anywhere. It's probably not much of an issue if you're a self-employed plumber, but there you go. So office politics usually involves gossip. Life in a boring, sterile workplace is probably livened up with a few rumours and bitchy comments behind other people's backs, but it goes deeper than that. Office politics is a type of power game. More specifically, it's what people with little power try to do to give themselves the impression of having a bit more influence. If you're gossiping about the person who keeps turning up late and then leaving early, then you're probably trying to give the impression that you work harder than them. Or if you're gossiping about what you overheard your manager talking about, then you probably want to give the impression that you have privileged information. Oh, by the way, if anyone wants to know something really juicy about one of our comrades, then come and see me afterwards. Don't tell anyone else. So office politics is a symptom that a workplace isn't cohesive. Managers don't like a lack of cohesion among staff, as this tends to have a knock-on effect in reducing productivity. So to improve cohesion, many organisations, especially larger, more corporate ones, will place emphasis on team building. Sometimes a department or a workplace will go on a team building day where they do activities or group exercises instead of their usual work. Tellingly, team building days often take place away from the office, as if it's recognised that the work environment tends to encourage division. On an away day, staff might find themselves split up into groups to awkwardly discuss what items might be of most use if they were stranded on a desert island or something like that. But I suspect that if team building days do work, and if they do knit staff teams back together again, then that's mostly because the staff have been united by the shared experience of feeling embarrassed and awkward. And a workplace might also try initiatives like Dress Down Friday or having healthy eating days or setting up its own choir or getting employees to pose naked and then making a calendar out of the photos, which I hope the SPGB never tries. My Form F will be in the post if there's ever a naked SPGB calendar. But these are only gestures, brief interruptions from the monotony. So if office politics is a corrosive way of dealing with alienation at work, and if team-building attempts are usually doomed to failure, are there any more positive ways of coping? Are there any other ways of coping? So what if we try and fight against alienation from within? What if we ignore hierarchies and job roles and disregard policies and procedures? If we try and mould our job to fit in with our own preferred way of doing things, then we're running a risk. Our role in the organisation is tailored to fit the overall ethos of that organisation, its overall purpose. A maverick personality who doesn't fit in with the status quo is less likely to have a positive influence and probably won't get very far within that organisation. In capitalist organisations, our individual personalities often end up as subordinate to the demands of our role or our function. If the job demands that we are ruthless, then a ruthless streak in us will probably emerge. And if it doesn't, then we risk losing our job. There are exceptions, of course, and a strong-minded, different type of person in a job role is one of the ways that organisations change and develop. But overall, the problems I've described are inherent in the way that capitalist organisations are structured, and so alienation will be with us for as long as capitalism is. We fetishise capitalist organisations. We come to accept that they're alien from us and that they have authority over us. The roles, hierarchies and group norms of the organisations all reinforce acceptance. But is there anything positive we can do in the meantime to cope with the effects of this kind of alienation? Not getting involved in office politics is one thing. And something else we can do is to try and challenge any lazy, unthinking assumptions of practices when we recognise it in ourselves. We should remind ourselves to question the way to do things, and think of other ways that we could work and live. If we don't do this, then our work environment could become sort of bogged down in apathy. And of course, we should also remember that for many of us, the best part of our job is who we work with. Many dull or stressful jobs have been made bearable by having colleagues we can have a laugh with or talk things through with. And many of us also like having the separation between those of us who we know at work and between those who we know at work and friends and family outside work. So having colleagues can widen our social circle and allow us to meet people we otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity to come into contact with. But this happens in spite of what I've described, not because of it. We aren't employed so we can get to know our colleagues, and often stopping work to have a chat about Coronation Street can be a tiny act of rebellion, even. Getting on well with your colleagues almost feels like a fog is clearing or something lost is being found. We get a similar feeling through cooperation. We sometimes occasionally get the feeling that we've really worked with other people rather than just worked alongside them. And when we work closely with others, our personalities have more of a chance to come through and develop. This is easiest to see when there's a tangible end product, if it could be a meal that a group of people have cooked together or something like that. A car could be an example of where you've got a satisfying end product made up of countless people's experience and skills. But however, we usually take our accomplishments for granted because they take place in a context of alienated, stressful and often forced labour. So the best way to reduce the impact of alienation is to get on well with our colleagues and appreciate the collective skills that we've got as a species. And then we can see some potential in how we could all work together. But the only way to get rid of alienation is to get rid of the social structures which cause it. Workplaces, and here's the last paragraph, as it were. Workplaces in a socialist society wouldn't lead to alienation or the manifestations of it which I've described. If a workplace is owned and democratically run by the community or the society of which it's a part, those involved with it wouldn't be alienated from it. They'd be a part of it. There would probably still need to be job descriptions and people having roles to play, but they wouldn't consume our identities in the way that they do under capitalism. There wouldn't need to be jealousy at what other people do, as this could be overcome by the cooperative nature of work in socialism. If someone wants to change jobs, there wouldn't be the barriers to getting training or experience in that. And resentment about someone else's status would be less likely in a democratic society without hierarchies. So we would be free to get involved in whatever roles we wanted, as there wouldn't be the economic and social constraints which prevent them as they do now. Thank you.